Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Dr. Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin in about 1928. He received the Nobel Prize in 1945. He did receive the award along with Dr. Howard Florey and Ernst Chain for the discovery of penicillin and its curative effect in various infectious diseases, end quote. However, in his Nobel Prize lecture, Dr. Fleming warned of the development of antibiotic resistance. Today, some 70 years later, some pathogenic bacterial species are resistant to most antibiotics. For some of us, it implies that the problem of antibiotic resistance is already out of control. On this program, we're going to discuss the problem of antibiotic resistance with infectious disease specialist Dr. Jay Butler and infectious disease pharmacist Dr. Thaddeus Wilkerson. Dr. Wilkerson is a PharmD, and he's an infectious disease pharmacist, as I said, at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. He's also the manager of ANMC's Antibiotic Stewardship Program. Dr. Jay Butler is the senior director of ANTHC's Division of Community Health Services. In the past, he served as director of the state's Division of Public Health, our state's first chief medical officer, and as an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control. Jay, welcome back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
That is nice to meet you.
Thank you very much.
So let's take a historical perspective and work up to date. Tell us, Jay, if you don't mind, a little bit about the history of antibiotics and how that gets us to where we are today.
Well, you've already mentioned Alexander Fleming and the discovery of antibiotics that are produced by molds and other microorganisms. There were also antimicrobial drugs that were developed initially as dyes, as chemicals. If we go back to the middle of the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution, textile mills were becoming mechanized, and the level of productivity to develop cloth for various purposes had just exponentially increased. What hadn't increased was the ability to color those cloths. Most of the dyes were still natural, made from various plants. And so there was a big effort focused on developing artificial dyes, chemicals that could quickly color lots of fabric in a color-fast way. These would be chemicals that could bind to proteins within the cloth fibers. One of the first dyes was a mauve. If you have been in a fashion museum, one of my wife's favorite pastimes, you'll notice that many of the clothes from the 1860s, 1870s are a dark red. It was at the same time that the science of bacteriology was being born, and it was realized that many infectious diseases were caused by bacteria. It was also recognized that these dyes also stained tissue as well as microorganisms differently, that when you looked under the microscope, if you had exposed these tissues to dyes, they were much more visible, and you could see things that you couldn't see just looking at tissue or microorganisms without the dyes. It was also noted that these dyes could inhibit the growth of the microorganisms. So this led then to the hypothesis that, well, these dyes attach to proteins, maybe they also attach to the proteins of the microorganisms, and by that mechanism can kill them. Paul Ehrlich was one of the German chemist, was one of the first people to really develop that. And his first dye was trypan red, which was effective against trypanosomiasis and African sleeping sickness, parasitic diseases. But then also he developed a drug that became known as compound 606 or salvarsan. 606. That was the 606th chemical he worked with. And it was found to be the first chemical that was really effective at treating syphilis. Syphilis was widespread at the time. Mercury was oftentimes used for treatment. Mercury, of course, is very toxic. It took months, if not years, of treatment. The saying at the time was one night with Venus followed by 1,000 nights with Mercury, because it just wasn't very effective. Whereas Salvarsan was much more effective. This led to other development of dyes, Prontosil, which is basically a sulfa drug, was developed in the 30s. It was found that in experimentally infected mice, it prevented streptococcal infections, which were a major cause of death and disability at the time. And it was used in humans to treat puerperal fever, that is, severe infections that occur after childbirth, and was found to be life-saving. Being a dye, it had the unpleasant side effect of turning the patient red. So there was continued work. And that led to sulfanilamide by the mid-1930s, which is very close to some of the modern sulfa drugs we have today. Thad, you may have prescribed trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole in your clinic in the past day or two. And
not long ago, if I can get away with that without getting into trouble on this program.
All right. Well, we're not, I didn't mention the trade names. I was very careful there. There was that line of chemistry approach. As you mentioned earlier, there was also the more biologic approach, and that gets us to Alexander Fleming. And that tells us a lot about how antimicrobial resistance can emerge. Fleming was working on substances that occurred naturally that seemed to inhibit bacteria, and he worked specifically with Staphylococcus aureus, or Staph aureus, many people know about. Many people know much more about it now because of MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. He was finding that there were substances in tears that could cause lysis of the organism. So he had called that the name that we actually still know it by, an enzyme called lysozyme. And he was playing around with all kinds of things. Lysozyme is in high concentrations in pike eggs. He discovered it was in higher concentrations in dog saliva than it is in human saliva. He had been working on auger plates with Staph aureus. And I think he enjoyed his work. It said that he actually used to do artwork on the auger plates, that he knew which bacteria would turn which colors, and he could draw pictures on the auger plates. He had, and the story here gets a little fuzzy because Fleming himself related it about 15 years after the actual event, and other people have reconstructed it a little differently. But what is apparent is he had been out of town for a while, and some of the plates that he had inoculated with Staph aureus had become contaminated with a mold. And when he got back, he observed that where the mold was growing, the colonies had lysed, just as they did with lysozyme. And he hypothesized that the mold, which were penicillium species, were producing a substance that was causing that, and he eventually called that substance penicillin.
Which was a big leap at that time, right? It sounds to me.
It was a big leap, but it was also an observation that had mm-hmm. been made by others. Mm-hmm. Once Fleming had presented and published his work, it wasn't immediately embraced, actually. I mean, Fleming mm-hmm. was described as a very soft-spoken man, a Scotsman. When he first presented this at a scientific meeting, there were no questions. He didn't oversell what he had observed. But many other people, as they began to grasp what he had done, realized they had seen the same thing and thought, oh, these are contaminated, and tossed them into the washer. So the unique thing about Fleming was he wasn't necessarily the first person to trip over this, but he was the first person to stop and look at what he had tripped over. Mm-hmm. As Louis Pasteur, the father of bacteriology, had observed, chance favors the prepared mind. And in fact, Pasteur, some 50 years earlier, had injected experimentally infected animals that were injected with Bacillus anthracis, the bacterium that causes anthrax. He had injected them also with microorganisms isolated from soil and found that those microorganisms inhibited the anthrax bacillus. So there had been observations that there's this competition between microorganisms, although it wasn't really understood how that was done until Fleming made his seminal observation. Now, you mentioned earlier that they received the Nobel Prize in 1945, a big period of time between 1928 and 1945. One of the challenges was being able to produce penicillin in pure enough and large enough batches to really use it as a drug. And that's where Howard Florey and his team at Oxford stepped in. And they were able to purify penicillin and produce it in large enough numbers in around 1940-1941. One of the initial reports in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, described seven consecutive patients who were treated with penicillin, doses that nowadays we would consider almost homeopathic. They were so small. But these were all patients that had subacute bacterial endocarditis, an infection of the heart valve, which was almost 100% fatal, and all seven of these people survived. So it really grabbed the attention of the world, and it was recognized that all kinds of infections that were very common and among the leading causes of death were now curable because of these new miracle drugs that had been identified. And then it led to a period of antimicrobial and antibiotic prospecting, looking for all the different organisms in the soil that could produce different kinds of antibiotics. And indeed, during the decade from 1940, 1950, and also to 1960, the number of medications that were available for treatment in the United States more or less doubled every decade, and part of that was driven by the number of anti-infective agents that were discovered.
Let me remind our listeners real quickly what you're doing as you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Jay Butler, an infectious disease specialist, and Dr. Thaddeus Wilkerson, an infectious disease pharmacist. Both of these gentlemen work at Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And our topic today is antibiotic resistance. Dr. Butler's just kind of taken us through some of the early history of the discovery of dyes, and then later something about other microorganisms that seem to control bacterial infection and parasitic infections that may lead to human disease. Jay, it's probably worthwhile also, you've kind of alluded to it before we get into this more, to understand how important of a discovery this was. And what I'm getting at is, at that period of time, if you had various skin infections, if you had bacterial endocarditis, if you delivered a baby, the likelihood of dying from infection was extremely high at that particular time. And we're now in an era where we don't understand that kind of stuff. And so now we're talking, and how do we reel this overuse of antibiotics in today?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. The things that we would consider very minor traumas nowadays were very often fatal. It's been said that more than 10% of skin infections ultimately were fatal at the time. And look around the room now, I'm sure all three of us have had skin infections at one time or another that have been cured thanks to antibiotics. The challenge with emerging resistance is one that comes down to selection pressure in many ways. In nature, these antibiotics are produced by microorganisms to try and knock out the competition. And we've been able to harness that to be able to produce these substances so that we can use them therapeutically. But bacteria also are able to evolve very quickly. We have to look at both the numbers and the concept of time when we're talking about the evolution of bacteria. Our bodies have roughly 10 trillion cells, but we're also, within our bodies, we have about 100 trillion bacteria. So 10 bacterial cells for every cell that is has part of our DNA. The generational time for many bacteria is on the order of minutes. So we have more bacteria in a single person than there have been human beings ever. Mm-hmm. We have a very rapid turnover time. So when there's an opportunity for a mutation to be selected and become advantageous to the organism, that can happen over a fairly short period of time. And as you mentioned earlier, Fleming and Florey mentioned their concern in 1945 when they received the Nobel Prize that the misuse of penicillin could lead to resistance. And indeed, it was only the very next year that the first penicillin-resistant strains of Staphylococcus aureus were isolated from Dr. Fleming's hospital, St. Mary's in London.
And to follow on that same line is how fast they began to notice bacteria, particularly Staph aureus, that was resistant to penicillin. There's been a recent report that was very, very fascinating. The English are very good at storing things, and they had stored some bacteria that were isolated from a young military soldier that was fighting in World War I in the trenches. And this was in 1915 or so, before Fleming's understanding of what was going on, beginning to understand. And the organism subsequently has been identified as Shigella, which is a common pathogen to this day. What was remarkable about this evaluation now of that organism that's been saved from before there was penicillin being manufactured is that that organism produced penicillin ACE, I believe. It was a multiply resistant organism, suggesting, again, that this battle between organisms has been going on probably well before man showed up on this planet. And it is kind of a war that's constantly going on despite us. We've just now creeped in and added a new dimension to the whole factor.
That's absolutely correct, and it is an amazing story. Ernest Cable was the soldier's name, died of dysentery, and his organism, Shigella dysenteria, was recently analyzed to look for drug resistance. And, of course, there were no antibiotic used as drugs at that time. It's interesting to think about the environment in which he died, though. The battlefield in the European theater in World War I was really quite nasty. Much of the battle was done in agricultural areas where the soil was contaminated with manures. It was quite muddy. There was lots of opportunity to be exposed to many types of microorganisms. So it actually raises the question of whether or not...
There were no restrooms, right?
There were no restrooms. And we're talking about a battlefield.
And you don't get up and walk to the outhouse either.
I am sure there was human excrement along with the manure. So there was probably quite a mixing of microorganisms that he was exposed to.
Right.
And, it's another example of how antibiotics have changed everything. Over 10 million people died in World War I, and it's estimated that about half of those deaths occurred because of infections. Wounds did not heal well. The practice at the time was to pack a wound with cloth that had been soaked in carbolic acid. That carbolic acid does kill some microorganisms, but it also kills human tissue. It inhibits white blood cells, the organisms you really want to be fighting, or the parts of our bodies that we really want to have fighting the infection. So it was not very effective, and it was a disaster. And as we've seen how casualties have changed over the 20th century during wartime, it's clear that antibiotics have made a huge difference in survival rates.
I'm going to remind listeners again, if you have questions or comments about the program today, there's a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, and you need to spell that out as one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Thaddeus, tell us a little bit about the mechanisms by which antibiotic resistance will work. This is a very complex subject, and we don't have a TV where you can draw things and people can see it, but give us some general idea how microorganisms develop resistance to treatments.
Sure, I'll try my best to do that. I'd first like to point out, Jay, you had mentioned, so they developed penicillin for Staph aureus. growing up and going to pharmacy school and in practice today, I would never consider using penicillin to treat Staph aureus. So that just shows you the difference in efficacy that has occurred. I was reading some statistics. 1950, 40% of hospital Staph aureus isolates were resistant. Another 10 years later, you're looking at 80%. In the United Kingdom and in the United States, it's less than 2% of Staph aureus isolates are susceptible. Mm-hmm. And for this particular organism, Staphylococcus aureus, the mechanism of resistance is enzymatic degradation. So in other words, there is a protein that the bug produces that can actually break down the antibiotic and rendering it ineffective. There are other bugs that have the capability of ejecting antibiotics once it gets into the cell, efflux mechanism, for example. And then there are also other enzymes that may modify the target. For instance, there are fluoroquinolones like ciprofloxacin and levofloxacin that inhibit DNA synthesis and the breakdown and restructuring. And so those particular bacteria can change where that particular antibiotic binds. There are also unique mechanisms where they can increase how thick their cell wall are. So inhibiting the penetration or the entry of the antibiotic into the cell, if that's where it's working. And for some organisms like Streptococci and Staph aureus, the issue might be binding of the actual antibiotic to the surface. Daptomycin is an example of one of those antibiotics where the affinity or the likelihood of that antibiotic to actually attach to the microbe and cause its activity can be impaired. So there are really three main mechanisms and multifactorial, and exposure to one particular antibiotic can actually activate more than just one mechanism. So it might not be just a change in the binding site or where that drug functions, but it might also eject more drug out through an efflux mechanism, and then it's not specific. So I could give you levofloxacin, and then you may actually be resistant or harbor bugs that are resistant to other antibiotics because it's not specific for what it's trying to push out of its cell membrane. Mm-hmm.
And in a generic sense, in an understanding sense, this is evolution that's happening right in front of our eyes. This is survival of the fittest that's been going on before we were making antibiotics. And because of the very rapid turnover of bacteria in particular, little slight changes, errors in their making of DNA or how they're reproducing, it selectively gives them advantage over that penicillin that fungus makes. And so that organism has developed this well before we had antibiotics available. Now we are just increasing the pressure on this in a much more rapid way by the introduction of man-made pharmaceuticals. But the battle's been going on for a long time. I think it's important to keep that perspective on everything.
Exactly. So the genetic material of the actual organism for resistance may have already been there and just now is being turned on due to the antibiotic pressure. There are some organisms that are quite promiscuous with their genetic material and will share some of their resistance genes, if you will, through mechanisms of plasmid transfer. So they get into these close-knit communities. They start talking to each other. Next thing you know, hey, do you have this resistance gene?
How about a little bit of my DNA?
Exactly. Exactly. So that's another mechanism with which, horizontal gene transfer is what it's called, but promiscuity amongst the organisms is another way to say it.
So what are the factors then that lead to this antibiotic resistance that human use of antibiotics have promulgated? How have we increased this occurrence of resistance?
Well, we've certainly contributed to it by not using antibiotics as carefully as Fleming and Florey charged us to do in 1945. It's estimated that as much as half of antibiotic prescriptions in medicine are probably not needed. And that's where people like Thaddeus are really turning medicine around, because he really focuses on how the antibiotics are used at the hospital to make sure they're used as effectively and as safely as possible. It's also estimated that, at least by tonnage, nearly 80% of antibiotics in the U.S. are used on agriculture. Now, that's a very controversial topic, and it's really not necessarily monitored how, you know, what gram goes into a human and what gram goes into feeds. Sometimes it's argued, well, it just takes a larger dose to treat a 1,500-pound Holstein than a 20-pound child with an otitis media. But antibiotics are also used as growth promoters, and that causes selection of resistant organisms. It's been
growth promoters in veterinary medicine.
In agriculture.
In agriculture.
So,
you know,
when we say veterinary medicine, I think of sick animals.
Not offspring necessarily.
These are in feedlots talking about use occurring. And these organisms can enter into us also, the resistance genes in these organisms can get into the food chain. They can also then, as Thaddeus was just mentioning, the genetic material can be shared across species even and begin to be seen in pathologic organisms. And there's been a couple of really elegant studies looking at how the antibiotic-resistant foods, antibiotic bacteria in our foods can then increase the risk of infection with antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
So as an example, you tell me if I'm wrong here, a chicken that is slaughtered who has been fed antibiotics to help them get larger, more efficient growth, is killed. It's not completely, all the bacteria in their system are not completely wiped out by whatever mechanism we're trying to do that. It ends up in your kitchen, and you're preparing that meal, and you might get some bacteria from that chicken on your hands, and then you put that hand in your mouth, and that bacteria now gets into your intestinal tract if it escapes the gauntlet of your stomach, and now you have these resistant bacteria that, for all intents and purposes, were developed by the use of antibiotics in the growth of that chicken. Is that what you're saying?
Right. That that Campylobacter infection that's causing the diarrhea may be a lot tougher to treat because of that, because that organism is already resistant to some of the antibiotics that we would want to use if we were going to treat that infection.
It's definitely important to point out, though, it's very difficult to trace that resistant bug within that chicken to the distribution center, to the grocery store, to the patient, and then who presents to the clinic with a urinary tract infection for E. coli. Mm-hmm. That's very complicated to be able to trace that, but there is some work that's being done in that arena.
Yeah, and it has been done. I'm thinking about outbreak of E. coli that was causing so much trouble in Europe was traced back to sprouts or something in a farm.
Right. And in Arizona and Flagstaff, there's some observation studies that are going on with gene sequencing as well, where they did sampling of chicken and looking at ESBL, urinary tract infections, in women.
Yeah, when we think of antibiotic resistance genes, it's maybe good to think of them as environmental contaminants. They exist in the environment within bacteria, but then those genetic determinants can be transferred among the bacteria. So as Thaddeus has pointed out, it may not always be that nice sequential, easily traced steps through an epidemiological study, but the selective pressure that occurs in the feedlot can eventually translate into bacteria that are resistant and that are pathogenic in humans.
It's a good thing you pointed out pathogenic, because we got to distinguish between organisms that are normal commensals or were colonized or carriers of those organisms versus having an active established infection. So when we're looking at risk factors for somebody who may be infected with a drug-resistant organism and have an established infection, oftentimes you're looking at elderly, debilitated individuals, people who have central lines, IV placements, or are on invasive devices where the normal barriers are broken down and what is considered a colonized organism then becomes pathogenic. So we have our human microbiome that Jay was referencing, all this extra bacteria that we've been acquired at birth and have been living with in, you know, a symbiotic relationship. So it's important to acknowledge that there are good bacteria within our bodies that help us ward off other infections as well. But we could replace, in essence, replace that good bacteria with these resistant bacteria, and we don't identify that unless we're looking for it or they come in with an infection.
Yeah, that's a critical point. Most bacteria are actually good. Yeah, they do good things for us in the environment. They give us some of our favorite foods and beverages. In our bodies, they also are a very important part of health. Mm-hmm. There's a good reason why we have so many bacteria.
And they help prevent infection.
But when that ecology, that population is altered, then we begin to see problems. And that's why some of the risk factors that Thaddeus just described are so important. Not only are people compromised because of their illness, they're also at higher risk of being treated with antibiotics, oftentimes appropriately, but that even that appropriate treatment can increase the risk for subsequent resistant infection.
Correct.
Let me, it's been a fast 30 minutes. We're already halfway through. I want to take our break and then we'll come back and really get into some of the significance of all this antibiotic resistance when we return. So let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we'll continue our discussion on antibiotic resistance with Drs. Thaddeus Wilkerson and Jay Butler. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is antibiotic resistance, a problem that's kind of defined by the fact that currently some pathogenic bacterial species are resistant to many, if not most, antibiotics we have available. Our guests are infectious disease specialist Dr. Jay Butler and infectious disease pharmacist Dr. Thaddeus Wilkerson. Both of these gentlemen are from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and are in the studio with me today. Before we proceed, I also want to remind everybody that this is World AIDS Day, December 1st. AIDS has been one of the great pandemics of humankind with somewhere in the neighborhood of 750,000 deaths just in the United States from AIDS and around 50,000 people, individuals yearly still acquiring this infection. It would behoove us all to learn as much as we can about how you might get AIDS and how you can protect yourself from getting this viral infection, which has a remarkable ability to develop its own resistance to treatment, by the way.
Absolutely.
Brenda, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Thanks for holding on.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering about those microbial soaps that come out, and I was wondering if they have contributed to this this situation we're in. And I will hang up the phone and listen to your answer on the radio. Thank you very much.
All right, Brenda, thanks for a very, very important question. All right, which one of you guys wants to handle this one?
Well, I think we probably both can, but I'll be happy to go first. It's a very good question. I think maybe the more important point is that the antibacterial soaps haven't really been shown to offer any clear advantages over just plain old soap and water. And if soap and water are not available, the alcohol-based hand cleaners will do the same thing. The antibacterial soaps contain chemicals which are intended to deactivate bacteria. Of course, there's now antibacterial countertops, antibacterial mattresses, all kinds of things that are being sold. And I think it gets us back to that point again that most bacteria are good, and we live literally surrounded and occupied by bacteria also. So the whether or not these antibacterial soaps offer any advantage over soap and water or alcohol-based cleaners has not been shown. And it's even discussed whether or not there might be some health risk associated with those compounds.
I would definitely echo those comments. There has been some literature looking at triclosan. That's one of the components of antibacterial soaps and demonstrating resistant organisms. And again, we have organisms that live with us that we are attempting to eliminate on our hands. I think the take-home message here is if your hands are soiled, to use soap and water. You're more likely to be aggressive about your hand-washing technique and getting at least a minimum of 20 seconds in there than using some of the sanitizers with a false sense of security associated with that. And just as a reminder for those using the alcohol-based sanitizers, it's really the drying effect that's most important for its cidal activity.
I think it might be worth just talking about how soap and water work because if I'm right about my understanding, it's less likely to ever cause resistant organisms. I'm assuming eventually something's going to develop resistance to triclosan and all those things that we're trying to kill bacteria, but soap and water works by, my understanding is soaps form a micelle. They make a small molecule that just picks things off the skin, and then you just wash them right off. There is no antibacterial effect going on. That's the mechanism by which soap and water works, which to me seems to be better ecologically, evolutionarily, and so forth.
I would agree with you, Thad. It's acting as a surfactant. You're literally lifting the bacteria up and off of the hands, so you're removing it, not attempting to actually kill it. And it's a good thing that we brought up hand washing because Clostridium difficile is one of the organisms that is really in the number one top list of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's urgent threats to public health as an adverse consequence to broad-spectrum antimicrobial exposure as well as other risk factors. And Clostridium difficile is an organism that is not killed by these alcohol-based sanitizers, and hand washing with soap and water to lift up the spores that they produce is what is most important to combat transmitting that infection to others within the household or within the hospital setting.
Unlike most of the other infections that we've been discussing, the issue with Clostridium difficile is not so much that it has become resistant as it is one of those bacteria that are there in very low concentrations in a normal mix of bacteria. But when people are on broad-spectrum antibiotics, that organism can grow to very high quantities, produce a toxin that causes a diarrhea that can be life-threatening. And indeed, the CDC estimates that as many as 14,000 people in the United States die of C. difficile infections every year.
So this is where the broad-spectrum antibiotics, sometimes used appropriately, and we want to make that clear here,
right,
can increase or change the ecology of the gastrointestinal bacteria, which are outnumber our cells in our body. People got to remember that, and lead to this dysbiosis, so to speak, where this bacteria now is going to cause us harm, whereas otherwise it wouldn't, which gets to why, dare I say it, fecal transplants have been a very beneficial mechanism, because trying to kill this bacteria with antibiotics may not be doing us much good as you begin to understand the microbiome.
And that's a highly effective strategy, right. Fecal transplants, right. Either through donors within the home that are pre-screened for any viruses. Mm-hmm. But there's also some new studies coming out about frozen stool encapsulated, mm-hmm. And there's some literature looking in and trials looking at artificial synthetic microbiota replacement therapies. But yes, very important.
Synthetic stool. It's mind-boggling.
Yes.
All right, enough of that.
I was the one who was going to go that low. I'm sorry.
Let's try to put a bigger face or a better face or a more appropriate face on this whole problem. How big a problem is antibiotic resistance today? Why should we be worried about it? Why has the president said we need to do something about this? Why is the CDC involved in such a big way?
As well as the World Health Organization.
It's not just us.
Correct. Yeah. It's considered a national and a global health threat, both for public health as well as for economic threats associated with the cost for treating a drug-resistant organism. It's estimated that there are 2 million people who are afflicted with resistant organisms to one or more antibiotics, and that you're looking at over 23,000 or 230,000 deaths associated to these multi-drug resistant organisms. And I think that due to the fact that we have become, one could say, lackadaisical with our use of antibiotics because we have developed this sense of security that there are going to be new antibiotics in development in the future because we, like Jay had mentioned, have been doubling the number of new antibiotics once they were first initially discovered in the 40s, 60s, and 70s. But that has changed. We're not doubling new antibiotics anymore. And in fact, within the past 5 years, I can count on one hand the number of new antibiotics that have been developed. And specifically, they're only a narrow target of pathogens where we have emerging what is called gram-negative rod resistant organisms. And so a lot of people may Google superbugs. And if they were to do that, they're going to find things like KPCs, or you're going to hear CREs. Or maybe even the New Delhi metallobated lactamase producing E. coli. So these are organisms that we pretty much are running out of antibiotics to treat. And in regard to carbapenemase resistant Enterobacteriaceae, the CRE, we are out of antibiotics to treat them. And in essence, that's where my expertise in trying to find a balance between toxicity and combining agents that weren't studied to treat these organisms for a particular type of infection, try to combine them, double, triple them up at the risk of potentially putting somebody on dialysis or having adverse consequences like seizures associated with the combinations.
Yeah, and I'll just add, it also drives up the cost of healthcare. Billions of dollars are required then to treat these infections that require different types of therapy. And what's, I suppose, most concerning is that we are seeing now, particularly some of the gram-negative rods, that have very few drugs that are available to treat. And we're going back to some of the old drugs that can still work, but were abandoned years ago because they were just too toxic. We're almost going back to the days of using mercury for syphilis in terms of the toxicity that we have to potentially tolerate to be able to achieve the cure that's needed to save the patient's life. I should add, we're fortunate in Alaska where we're not seeing as much of that as in the northeastern United States.
Correct.
So there are a lot of regional differences in resistance, although as we start talking more about how we use antibiotics, it's important to recognize that there are also regional variations in the per capita prescription rate of antibiotics. And actually, the West Coast is lower than the Deep South and the Midwest, which I think are the two areas with the highest rates of antibiotic use.
Just quickly, I want to. You use the word gram-negative, about gram-negative bacteria, primarily gastrointestinal bacteria. So there are some kinds of bacteria that, it, at least it appears to me as a physician listening to you guys, that is far, far more likely to develop these resistance, probably because of the just local ecology in the gastrointestinal tract, as opposed to, let's say, group A beta hemolytic strep, which has been exposed to all these antibiotics over all the same time that all these gram-negatives, but it's still exquisitely sensitive to penicillin.
Still works.
So what the heck? So there's definitely local differences, not only in the New England and here, but there's, we're talking about different bacteria that have different modes and mechanisms and rates of development of resistance.
Correct. So in essence, when you're dealing with streptococci, you're dealing with penicillin binding. It's a very specific type of enzyme or target change. When you're dealing with the gram-negative rods, often there are multiple mechanisms of resistance occurring. A lot of them are mediated by these efflux or porin mutations. In essence, the antibiotic, the drug, cannot get to the site where it needs to do its job, and the antibiotic, the microbes have developed ways to get the drug away from that site, and or change the site where the antibiotic is supposed to work, as I had mentioned previously with the mechanism. So there are multiple modalities occurring with these types of organisms, and specifically with carbapenemase-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, it could be mediated by porin, so pushing the drug out, or it could be an enzymatic degradation of our last line agents. Our super drugs, if you will, to combat the superbugs are failing this fight.
Let me, one more time, I'm going to give our phone number, then I'm going to take a phone, or an email that's been waiting for a while, and then we're going to talk about what are the options, what's national recommendations to try to improve our current situation. So if you're listening, you got a local number, 550-8433. That's our local number. You can reach us here in the next 10 minutes or so. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So I had an email before the program, and I want to make sure we get that since it was somebody took the time to get ahead of the game on this. And this is a person who is calling in and saying, I've had two total shoulder replacements in the last 8 years. I've been told I must take prophylactic antibiotics prior to any procedure, such as even teeth cleaning, which I have 3 times a year. And she tells us that she takes amoxicillin or Keflex for that. And so her questions, she's 72 years old. The question is, will this, quote, barrage, end quote, of antibiotics make me resistant to antibiotics? Should I develop if I were to develop an unrelated serious infection or other conditions requiring them? So her first question is, all these antibiotics, you guys might want to answer, is it appropriate? And two, is it going to make her potentially at risk if she were to need these antibiotics?
Well, I think it's important to start with, oftentimes the use of antibiotics is appropriate, and that includes in certain settings prophylactic use of antibiotics. Before surgery, there are very specific guidelines now on when the antibiotic should be given. Oftentimes that's done in the hospital. If we're talking about antibiotic prophylaxis that occurs, for instance, for a dental procedure or for a urinary tract procedure, those are specifically recommended for people who have certain heart problems to reduce the risk of infection involving the heart valves. And those are very important things to do. The risk is there, but certainly it's much lower when we're talking about a very short course of antibiotics, such as what's used to prevent infection before a surgical or a dental procedure.
And in this particular patient case, it's my assumption she probably has hardware within that replacement. There might be concerns for infection of the actual bones surrounding the hardware that's in place and the development of biofilm, which can be very, very difficult to treat and often may require removal of that prosthetic device. So I would agree with Jay that duration, if it's short, and the agents she had selected are relatively narrow spectrum. In fact, when with the work that I do with antimicrobial stewardship, I often attempt to get providers to narrow to these particular agents. So her risk for harboring a multi-drug resistant organism is likely low with the exposures peri-procedure with this particular case.
And what we're saying, and again, you guys correct me because I'm not the infectious disease expert here, but when we talk about hardware, we're talking about titanium replacement, heart valves and things, which do not have their own blood supply and which, when they get contaminated or get organisms on it, that's how the antibiotics get there. So we got problems. And so there may be times and other illnesses for which prophylaxis, that means antibiotics before procedures, is recommended. That does not mean that everyone out there needs prophylactic antibiotics before surgeries.
Correct.
And so forth. And in fact, the recommendations for prophylaxis have been backing away.
That's right.
Partly because of this, partly because of the realization we were overdoing the antibiotics, that people weren't needing them as much as we thought.
The most important thing when it comes to antibiotic delivery perioperative at the time of the procedure is getting sufficient amount of drug within the blood at the time the incision is made, and then stopping antibiotics as soon as the procedure is completed, or continuing intraoperative if they're prolonged procedures. But there is not a lot of strong data to support continuing antibiotics after the procedure. So there are actually clinical guidelines and quality measure initiatives that are looking to make sure antibiotics are stopped within 24 to 48 hours, depending upon the procedure.
Mm-hmm. I hear that as more and more science, more and more evidence we have, the better and better we can use the armamentarium that we have effectively.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry, I got to throw in. We still need science out there, guys. All right. So how are we addressing the problem? I read here that there's four key actions that the CDC is suggesting after discussion with experts that we need to be thinking about here.
Well, the four key things are, first of all, prevent the infections to begin with. So that involves very basic things, immunizations. We've already discussed hand washing, and I think it's probably worth emphasizing here that we recognize that in parts of Alaska, hand washing is still very difficult to do because running water is not available. And work has been done that shows that in our villages that don't have running water, there are higher rates of both skin and respiratory tract infections. Second, surveillance. We need to know what's going on with the drug-resistant bacteria. That in some ways is becoming more difficult because of some of the scientific progress. We more and more diagnose infectious diseases with rapid tests that tell us whether or not the infection is there, but may not tell us whether or not the infection is drug resistant. So we have to be able to set up mechanisms to be able to sample some of those clinical specimens to determine whether or not the resistance is a problem. And I think Neisseria gonorrhea is a great example of that, where we have great concerns about emergence of resistance. Third, we need to promote the development of new drugs. The number of new drugs has really dropped fairly dramatically in recent years, particularly drugs to treat bacterial infections. And finally, we need to improve the use of the antibiotics that we have so that we're using the right drug at the right dose at the right time for the right organism. And this offers the advantage of not only achieving a cure, but reducing the toxicity and also reducing the cost of healthcare.
It seems very simple, very four-step strategy to combat a global health threat, but it's
not.
It requires a lot of work and coordinated care, and it's not only the responsibility of the infectious diseases pharmacists or the consultants or even the pediatrician. It's the responsibility of anybody who has the prescriptive authority to prescribe an antibiotic. And I teach the UAA Physician Assistance Program in their antibiotic block, and I pretty much tell them that you ultimately have a power here, but an ultimate responsibility to do no harm to your patients first. And so the recipient of the antibiotic is also needs to be engaged in this should not go drug-seeking, direct-to-consumer advertising saying, I need this antibiotic, or calling into a clinic, I have cough, cold, can you call me in a Z-Pak? That should be eliminated. So I think physician, provider, nurse education regarding the appropriateness in use of antibiotics is huge, but education only takes you so far. So unlike other nations, like the European nation, we don't have fully public health services available. So access to a lot of this utilization data is limited. But the CDC is moving forward with that, with the National Healthcare Safety Network, and providing an antibiotic use and resistance module where hospitals can send their data to the CDC so that we can have some data to look to see how we're doing to like facilities on our use. But that's still in its infancy. In looking at legislation, you had mentioned Obama's executive order that was released on September 18th, pretty much stating that at the end of 2016, he would pretty much has a federal mandate stating that all acute care facilities should have an antimicrobial stewardship program in place. And that's only going to be expanding out to the community setting. So we're talking about dialysis centers. We're talking about day surgery clinics, as well as, you know, primary care. So we're moving in that direction in the United States, but we definitely have a lot more room to grow, and there's a lot of momentum.
And this is a movement that's not meant to take away the authority or the autonomy of the physician or the patient, but it creates the administrative controls to make sure that the best possible drugs are being used in the best possible way. Things have changed a lot over 50 years. I mean, we're sort of wringing our hands that we don't have more drugs, but compared to Thad, when we were in medical school, I'm not saying we were old, but a bad night in the emergency department was when there was a mastodon mauling. You know, we had a fairly limited number of antimicrobial drugs. And as long as we knew the doses of ampicillin and chloramphenicol and erythromycin, okay, I said I was going to show
great,
my age.
Great medicine, by the way.
We were pretty good. And, you know, I was sort of a show-off third-year student because I could name all the third-generation cephalosporins to the surgery attending. You know, it's much more complicated than that today.
But I think to get back to looking at the core elements and strategies, we need to make sure to address antibiotics within agriculture as well. I mean, if we're looking at 70-80% of our antibiotics use in the United States is going towards
food. And the FDA is beginning to do that.
They are.
It's somewhat of a voluntary request right
Correct.
Now. But obviously, if 80% by weight of antibiotics used in this country come or in agriculture, then we need to look at that. Well, we have about 1 minute. I have to apologize to Peter, who's been holding for a phone call, but I don't think we're going to have time to make that. So what do we want to leave our listeners understanding and remembering about this this problem?
Well, I think there is good news also. I mean, I think people, there's so much concern about things like Ebola right now. And, you know, it's appropriate that we pay attention to what's emerging in the world of infectious diseases. But we also have new tools for prevention. We haven't really talked about drug-resistant pneumococcal infections. And part of that's because the 13-valent vaccine that has been used routinely since 2010 has made such an impact on the rates of those diseases, particularly the bloodstream infections and meningitis, that we are seeing a lot less drug resistance in that particular organism because we are preventing the infection to begin with.
I think for the public, they should be familiar with the antibiotics they've received in the past, be aware of when antibiotics work and when they don't, and to assist their healthcare provider in making the appropriate selection and response to that treatment.
My thanks to Dr. Jay Butler and Dr. Thaddeus Wilkerson for the program today. If you want to continue this program, you can join us on Facebook at alaskapublic.org. Next week, Think Feet. We're going to have Anchorage podiatrist Dr. Ken Swayman return, so we'll be addressing your concerns about foot and ankle problems. Pat Yak is chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey helped us today as both the web editor and our audio engineer. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day out there.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.